Now, our next speaker is Paul Reevely. Paul is an emergency physician in adult and pediatric medicine in the Bristol Royal Infirmary Hospital. Paul spent many years in the British Army and would have seen lots of different injury patterns, and he's going to talk to us this morning about pediatric blast injuries. So it's a tough topic, so hold tight.
Oh, thanks. Does it work? Thank you very much for having me. Thank you very much, organisers. I'm feeling a bit uncomfortable. They've taken away my lectern. I've got a mic. I've got a microphone strapped to my face. I don't know if I should talk to you or break out into Sister Sledge. And when I woke up this morning, I had my kids' socks in my bag. So I did have my own pants though, so I'm not that uncomfortable. Anyway, as I said, I'm going to talk about blast injury. And as opposed to good hard research, which was an excellent talk, thank you, this is a bit more what I did my holidays talk, which is okay, I guess, but we'll see how we go. I spent 18 years in the British Army dealing with injured people, some of which were children, and that's me drifting in the distance on the end of that little dot, which is a parachute at a pretty brisk 24 feet a second towards Oxfordshire on my way to my own blunt pelvic trauma. So there we go. Right, so a little bit of a plug. This lady, if you don't know who it is, and it is a lady, it's just a bit of a blurry photograph, is Eglantine Jebb, and she was one of the co-founders of Save the Children. 100 years ago this month, she said, every war is a war against children. And they're celebrating the 100-year anniversary this year. And she's absolutely right. Continuing today, there are hundreds, millions of children at risk of blast injury around the world. Save the Children estimate 1 in 5 is living in a conflict zone where they may be exposed to blast injury. So it is almost a public health problem in parts of the world where it is extremely common. And in Gaza, in recent years of conflict, 50 to 60% of the casualties have been children. In Syria, in the non-governmental, government-controlled areas, it's 25%. So if you are a Syrian anything, you will be dealing with blast-injured children, amongst other casualties. And you may recognize this picture. Very sad. This is Safi, who was 6 or 7, maybe younger, who was one of the victims in Manchester. So if you're very unlucky in other parts of the world, you may come across it. But in 2017, 10,500 children were killed or maimed as a result of blast injury worldwide. So a little bit about the physics, because as in all trauma, we need to think about the mechanisms behind it. You need to understand what happens at the point of impact. So what you see in a blast injury, which is unique to all other types of trauma, is that you have the blast wave. So when you have an explosion, you get a sudden release of large amounts of energy, which create this blast wave going forward, which is an overpressure compressed front of air, or whatever the blast is, traveling through liquid air in most cases. And in any other trauma, you don't have this. So the first thing that will hit you is this very high-speed front of pressure, and that will deliver energy to whatever it hits. Okay, so in terms of lethality, it's not too bad, unless you're standing right next to it. But this is the only bit of blast trauma which is unique to any of the other traumas you've seen. So all the other things that happen in an explosion, you will have seen through blunt penetrating and all that kind of stuff, so we'll come back to it. This is a 155 military shell, and it's about 100 kilograms. The thing next to it is what fires it. It's a British piece of kit, and it can fire 3 of those at you in 10 seconds. So it's a very destructive piece of equipment. If you're standing 50 feet from that blast, you will die. You will either be ripped apart, or you'll be killed by the fragment. If you are standing 80 feet, you may die from the fragment injury, but you won't die probably from the blast, at least not initially. If you are standing 1,800 feet from that blast, you are still at risk of fragment injury. So if you're in a shopping centre and a policeman says, would you kindly clear the area, there's going to be an explosion, I strongly recommend you give up your ambition to have a pret-a-manger sandwich and go home. So there are 2 main injuries that I want you to think about. So blast will cause disruption where there's a change in the density between 2 tissues. In particular, we've got an air-liquid interface. So what you will see initially is very little. If you have just been exposed to blast, you might see a completely uninjured patient. They may be a little tachycardic, they may be a little tachypneic, they look a bit scared, but they will not present yet with any symptoms or significant symptoms or signs of injury. So there are two injuries I'll highlight to you. One is blast gut. You get a shear and little basically explosions at the tissue liquid air interface, and that will present over a period of hours, even days. You eventually have a devitalized ischemic gut with perforation. So these patients need to be watched based on where they were and your assessment of the mechanism in the blast. Now, blasts can be complicated. If you've just got one wave passing through you away from that shopping center, that's fine. If you're in a building or an enclosed space, the blast will rattle around. If we were to have an explosion here at the front now, it would bounce off these walls, amplify, and expose us to lots of waves of blast. We'd be in all sorts of trouble. But if you're sitting behind a pillar at the back, you might very well survive from being shielded from that blast. So think about where it's happened, where the patient was. The other and commonest cause of death in terms of primary injury is blast lung. So these are the patients who will come in. Like I say, they may be a little bit tachycardic, a little bit tachypneic. They will otherwise be okay. They're being exposed to primary blast only. But in the alveoli and in the capillaries, they've had a push-pull shear, and they will develop over a period of hours, depending on the energy they've been exposed to, a blast lung or what is effectively an acute lung injury. And these patients will come in alive and die. And we saw lots of patients like this in Northern Ireland, where blast was a very common mechanism, where you were exposed to just the primary wave. So you've got to be very vigilant for abnormal signs in these patients, which we all are for children anyway. After the primary blast, you get the more sort of meaty end of it. And I apologize for the graphic nature of this slide. I'm not putting up just to show you what's, you know, more graphic. But think about the energy of what they've been exposed to. This guy, the foot up top right, is what we used to call a bit of a heel popper or a toe popper, and it's been a very small energy mechanism. He might lose the foot, he might keep it, but it's going to be okay, the leg's going to be okay. It goes round to a slightly higher energy injury there, bottom left, where that whole lower limb has been lower leg has been devitalized. None of that tissue is looking very clever. He has got a tourniquet on it, but obviously the meaty end is very dead, but all that tissue's been ripped and the blast energy has gone through it, and he's got muck and all sorts up there. Down to the very big. Now, what you need to know about these patients is, yes, they've lost their leg and it looks awful, but we've stopped the bleeding. But think about where their leg was at the point it was ripped off their body. Okay, it wasn't just here, it was somewhere up around the back of the head. So the incidence of pelvic injury and abdominal injury is huge, because they've literally been pulled around and pulled apart. Secondary injury is when you get a penetrating injury to the body. So this is cavitation. Okay, now it's a still of cavitation. When you see the little hole either side of the tissue, that's all you see, and the tissue's all in there. What has happened at the point of injury, and again, the energy transfer is dependent on the speed, the size or the weight, the motion of the missile through the air when it hits that tissue, and also to the density of the tissue. So in real life, this is an American advert for buying munitions, but at least it's got some educational content. But look at what has happened. If you've been shot through the arse, that's what's happened to it on the way through. So you haven't just got a hole either side, you've got complete mass destruction on the inside, and all that tissue is dead or dying. So we had one patient in Bristol from Manchester, and it was a fragment injury, and had a little hole in the leg, but when we delved underneath it, we'd never seen this kind of before, at least most of us hadn't. Lots of dead tissue, and it was a bit of a surprise. So just to show how energy dissipates as it goes through a couple of blocks, you've got high energy at the front and a much lower energy wound at the back. Okay, and again, quite impressive photography. The moral of this story is, if you're going to get shot, stand behind someone. So that's what you will see in vivo, okay, and that's an exit wound. Okay, well, that's the meaty bit. If you saw that, you think that's bad, isn't it? So you won't always see an exit wound. You'll see an entry wound, and somewhere in there, all that energy has been dissipated. So think about what has hit the patient, okay? Now, in this case, it's hit very dense tissue. So all of the energy, practically, has been transferred to that target. That is the tenet of military practice. We are all about transferring energy to our target. And as a result, if you get hit in a lower density place, then there's less energy transferred to your body. So my theory, and for Christ's sake, don't tweet this, because it's just my theory and I made it up, is if you get shot through the right tit, you'll probably be all right, because you only got lung behind it. If you get through the left, you probably get your heart. So low density areas present to the target only. So that tissue's dead, and what we're going to do is cut it away. And that's all we're going to do, just chop it off, down to what looks like live tissue. We're going to stabilize that that fracture. We don't need to do anything clever. We certainly don't want to close it. We certainly don't want to fix it. In fact, putting an X-fix on is way more than you would normally do in a conflict zone. You just stabilize it with whatever you have. Taking away the dead tissue straight away is very important. And this is a little elegant, made-up way of approximating the wound by a guy called Pete Templeton, who I mentioned because he very sadly died at the age of 50, but he was a wonderful pediatric orthopedic surgeon. Tertiary and quaternary injuries are when you get thrown against the wall and then the wall collapses on you, so blunt. So we've seen lots of blunt trauma in our careers, and there's nothing different about this. So it's body displacement or object displacement that falls on top of you, so standard blunt trauma. Quaternary is everything else that happens as a result of that explosion. So burns, toxic, psychological. If you've got underlying disease that's exacerbated by it, that's a quaternary injury as well. So that's your classification of blast. It is the total package of injury. It has absolutely everything. It's the mother of all trauma. Lex Luger, his ring name was the total package. So graphic, apologize, I'll move on. When you are presented with this child, what are you going to do? What is your approach? I'm not asking you to tell me. What you are definitely not going to do is start panicking, correct? Now, can I put, please, I know that there's a predominantly pediatric audience here, but who's like me, a part-time pediatrician? As in, you see adults as well. Okay, there's a number of you here. Great. Yeah, keep them up, keep them up. This is the cephalopod theory, okay? Now, I know that some people have heard this from me before, and it has occasionally been tweeted, not by me, I hasten to add, because I have no evidence behind it whatsoever. That is a child, okay? That's my child. He is a fearsome little bastard sometimes. But he is just a child. I occasionally swear to stop my videos going on websites. This is an octopus and a cephalopod, correct? When we are presented with one of these, sometimes we behave like we are presented with one of these. Now, I would understand it if you were presented with an injured octopus that you went to ratchet and panicked, okay? But you are not. You are presented with a child, and this is the bit about despeciation. We have spent a long time speciating the child. Okay, now, if you are an expert pediatrician, that's fine. But if, like most children, you are met by someone who doesn't do pediatrics all the time, which is a reality around the world, you don't need to be scared out of treating that child. You need to recognize them not as something different to a little adult, but something that is still a human being. Okay, so think about that. Rather than, this is very different and very difficult. Children are still, to my knowledge, a member of the human race. There he is. And to prove it, when I was in Afghanistan treating patients, this is Harry. And Harry lost his legs in his early 20s. He was an extremely fit young soldier. And he had the same physiology, give or take, as a child. He compensated to the point of extremis, and he survived. So we never thought about these patients in a different way. We just treated them. But what we were doing was treating very pediatric physiology. And if to prove that he's still a child, that is a dessert that he made, which has popping candy in it. And you had to clear the minefield on your way to eating your pudding. Hence, he's called Harry the Sicko. If you are presented with that, I don't know how to help you. So, bottom line here, and I'm getting towards the end, are we looking for differences that aren't there? I get asked, for whatever reason, to talk about pediatric trauma, but I sometimes sit at home in a cold sweat thinking, what is different? What can I tell you that is different about pediatric trauma? Other than the usual, oh, never fix cardiac output, boring, thank you. But what is different? Are we mining a seam that isn't really there, or do we need to think of it in a different way? Most children are not met by a pediatric trauma expert. They may be met by a pediatrician or a trauma expert or an endocrinologist or a GP or whatever it is. If you meet some Syrian doctors, none of them were pediatric trauma experts 7 years ago. So how do you do it? Our assessment structure is the same. These are the messages we should push. Our assessment is the same as it is for an adult in terms of its structure. The injuries are largely the same in different patterns, albeit, so they have a higher percentage of skull fracture. They have a higher ISS on average. They have a higher mortality. They get more penetrating injuries because we know they're a bit smaller, and they're more multiply injured because they are smaller. But the intervention for those injuries is almost the same, give or take some exceptions like solid organ injury. We haven't taken a spleen out of a patient in 25 years in Bristol for solid organ injury. But I will acknowledge that the pitfalls, if you want to focus on any, are the same. I still see people missing the injured child. Not because they don't think that they're injured, because if you've lost your legs, you're very clearly injured. But because we will run up our own fundaments trying to persuade ourselves that that child is not injured. So recognition amongst all of us, paediatricians included, can be still a challenge. Ignoring abnormal signs. If I could be boring once, never, ever, ever ignore a tachycardia in a child that's been involved in a significant injury. It is not pain. It is not fear. It is something else until you're absolutely sure. And then imaging. Image the hell out of them. Okay? Because if you've been involved in one of those blasts, you will have injuries that you will not see for days and days and days. So Rui in Manchester has a different opinion on this, but he will be finding injuries on those scans for years to come that he didn't see the first time. Not, maybe not significant, but they're there. So very quickly, because I'm running out of time, the principles of resuscitation, going back to the original work, when we looked at coagulopathy and all that kind of stuff, should be considered the same. Okay, are we mining a seam that isn't there? We know that children are coagulopathic, 13% in civilian major trauma. And we know we have an approach for coagulopathy and trauma. It's massive transfusion and balanced products. Damage control approach, this is the HMS Nottingham. It hit a massive rock off Australia, pretty much the biggest charted rock in the sea, and it nearly went down. Damage control, they fixed it. It couldn't fight, but it could still sail. We're all about getting the patient to the next stage in damage control. Classically, balanced transfusion, stopping the bleeding, followed by focused surgery, not 6 hours of definitive surgery. They get 60 minutes with your patient, and then critical care. But actually what we should be doing is all of it at once, the big trauma team approach with that planned episode. Am I okay? Get it to the pediatric surgeon or the trauma surgeon. Hybrid resuscitation, a tenet of military practice in adults. Can we have a hypotensive spell in children? Well, probably not, because you're sailing too close to the wind, even by my casual approach. But what we can do is consider that for a period of time, they need clot stability. And whether you resuscitate them after an hour or leave them to go, there's clearly a period that of hypovolemia that is not of benefit. But in children, we don't allow them to have that period at all. So if you resuscitate them straight away, your clot doesn't form. If you resuscitate them after a time, we are breaking all boundaries of APLS and all that kind of stuff. But hypovolemic resuscitation, cautious, 5 mL boluses, aiming for improvement, not aiming for normal physiology, is what I would urge. Okay, they're in great hands. They're in a safe place. Watch the child, resuscitate them, measure them, and keep going. Not banging in fluid till you get pink fingertips in the first 10 seconds. So what do we need for our for this is my last slide. What do we need for that approach to the blast injured child? We need our trauma team. We need to empower people not to fear the child and treat them like an octopus. We need a physiological strategy based on sensible, controlled resuscitation, based on the knowledge that we have from other models, including the adult. And we need a surgical strategy that involves just stopping the bleeding and not much more. And then we need the critical care approach as well. And that's it. And if you get it right, even if your bowel's hanging out, you still get a happy child at the end of it.